Okay, so it's 1 minute past two, so we'll get going. First of all, could someone type in the chat to confirm that they can hear me? Excellent, thanks very much. So welcome to the fourth weekly COVID-19 update. As a reminder, my name is Nick Matheson. I'm one of the PIs in the Cambridge Institute for Therapeutic Immunology and Infectious Disease. I'm also one of the infectious diseases consultants in Addenbrooke's Hospital. And I should just emphasize that our institute is very much open for business, that business being COVID-19 research. So this week, I'm going to be joined by James Thavanthiran, who's one of our clinical immunologists, who's going to talk about immune dysregulation in COVID-19 infection and what implications that might have for the pathogenesis and ultimately treatment of the disease. I'm going to start with an update, firstly on a topic close to my heart, and then on the progress of the epidemic. So you'll recall that two episodes ago, Babak Javid, one of our colleagues, talked about the transmission of SARS-CoV-2, and in particular about the possibility that mass wearing of face masks might be a useful intervention to mitigate the pandemic. And I mentioned last week that a number of public bodies had been considering the evidence on this, including the CDC in the USA, which is now recommending the use of masks by the general public in situations where social distancing is not possible, such as public transport or in stores. And so I just thought I'd update once more on this story. And so this is partly in relation to a couple of articles in the British Medical Journal this week, the first of which was an editorial by Babak, myself, and also Mike Weeks. And the second was a very thoughtful analysis piece on the same subject. The upshot of both our recommendations is that public mask wearing may well have a role in controlling the COVID-19 epidemic, and certainly it's unlikely to do harm. And so on the basis of the precautionary principle, we think it's a good idea. I mentioned last week there is a bit of a change in attitude to this. A number of other health bodies, not just the CDC, are coming around to this opinion. And earlier this week, the chief scientific officer in the UK that they would in fact review their guidance on this, as reported in the Mail Online on the right, so that must be true. I have to say, I'm not expecting a change in UK government policy on this anytime soon, however, because Sir Patrick did emphasise that, if there's a significant change in the scientific evidence, then the UK policy would change, the implication being that unless someone comes forward with a randomised controlled trial of mask wearing, there will be no change in UK policy. This is obviously unlikely, and I therefore don't expect this. However, I'll continue to update on this point, and I may be proven wrong. So 1 week ago, this is what SARS-CoV-2 case numbers in the UK were looking like. On the y-axis, the number of UK cases or deaths, the green and red lines and bars respectively, time on the x-axis. And in particular, I made the point that over the preceding several days, it looked like the number of new cases of COVID-19 had plateaued, leading to a straight line rather than an exponentially rising curve in the total number of cases shown by the green line, and a number of bars of similar height, shown by the green bars in the bottom right. And so we were hopeful 1 week ago that the UK had roughly reached its peak number of new admissions. We were expecting peak health resource utilisation, things like medical beds and ICU beds, to peak around 1 week later. That's about now. So were we right? And how have things unfolded since then? Well, first of all, the UK government has updated the portal they use to report to us, the public, the number of positive tests and indeed deaths caused by SARS-CoV-2. And these screenshots are from the new updated portal. And certainly you would be forgiven if you compared this figure with these figures for thinking that the number of new cases in the UK, actually this is England, but the number of new cases in the UK had really fallen dramatically over the last two or three days, almost to zero. I just show this as a little bit of a health warning, because as well as changing the portal through which you access the results, the basis of the reporting has been changed so that the number of new cases is now shown by specimen date rather than result date. And so what this introduces in practice is a lag of two or three days. So for example, specimens that were taken yesterday will not yet be resulted, and therefore it will appear that there were very few cases over the last one, two or three days. So the appearance of this curve is unfortunately an artifact of the change in reporting. So what does it actually look like? Well, we can go straight to the top to find the answer. So this is one of the slides from the, well, you can see the source in the top right. So this is one of the slides presented in the Daily UK briefing. And this shows the more familiar way of reporting the data that we're used to. So number of cases on the y-axis, date on the x-axis, and the date in this case representing the date of the result. But actually, although the number has not fallen as dramatically as it appeared here, you can see that the number really has plateaued exactly as we were expecting. And that's been borne out in our local data as well. So this is admissions to Adam Brooks Hospital on the y-axis, date on the x-axis. And again, you can see that we appear to have plateaued, or more optimistically, maybe be past the peak. So where does that put us overall? So this is the slide from last week showing the number of new cases per day on the y-axis, rebased to the number of days since 50 new cases on the x-axis. China in blue, Italy in gold, France in green, and the UK in red, and indicated by the respectively coloured arrows, the day when stringent social distancing measures or lockdown was introduced in the respective countries. You'll recall me saying that because of the natural history of the disease, the expectation is that around two or perhaps 3 weeks after the introduction of lockdown, we'd expect to see the peak in number of new cases. And so just continuing these lines to come right up to date, you'll see that this has basically been borne out. So again, you'll see that these lines really follow each other very closely. Italy, the UK, and France all locked down at similar points in the epidemic, and the number of new cases per day in the respective countries has been more or less comparable. Now, where does that leave us overall? Is it a good or a bad thing? Well, I'll leave you to make your own judgment on that, but this is another slide from the same briefing given by the UK government yesterday, which again shows on the y-axis, this time deaths rather than cases, and days on the x-axis. Again, days since 50 deaths per day, exactly as in the previous graph. So the difference is we're looking at deaths rather than cases here. And you can see that, as I showed previously, the UK and Italy locked down at more or less the same point in the epidemic, rather similar to France. And this is borne out exactly by the trend in deaths that we're seeing. You can see the UK, point with the arrow here, green line, following the number of deaths in Italy almost exactly. France has a slightly bigger population, so the total number of deaths is slightly greater. Germany, you'll notice, has got far fewer deaths. So it is what it is, and we are where we are. But the expectation from here is that the number of deaths per day should start to decline, and that trend has been seen over the last 2 to 3 days. And so we're now really starting to think about post-peak sort of scenarios. And so I was going to talk through this paper today, which is a modelling paper from Science that was published a couple of days ago, about the transmission dynamics of SARS-CoV-2. This paper is trying to make predictions of various post-peak scenarios. I then thought it's quite difficult to critique these sorts of modelling papers. So instead of just taking you through it today, I thought I would make a request, and that is, if any of the learned members of the audience have particular expertise in this area, perhaps they could email me at the address shown with their comments and analysis of this paper. And I'll then talk through it next week, because I think it's important, but armed with the expert critique that I received by email. So we'll see how well this works. But that's the plan for next week. So I'm now going to hand over to James. As I say, one of our clinical immunologists. It will become clear over the course of his talk why I asked him to give it. And I will now switch the slides. Okay, James, over to you.
So thank you, Nick. So I'm a clinical immunologist who looks after patients with inborn errors of immunity and carries out research into the adaptive immune response. I'm grateful for Nick inviting me to give this seminar, which stems from conversations we were having last week in relation to the concerns highlighted in this Guardian article. Notice the difference in our reading material. The full article reports the current media understanding of COVID-19 caused by infection with SARS-CoV-2 virus. My talk relates to the section detailing current views on why people are dying in developed countries from this infection. In this section, the article mentions respiratory failure, but highlights how people are dying from excessive inflammation in what is termed a cytokine storm. Medics more formally refer to this as a cytokine release syndrome. In other conditions, this is treated by blocking the immune hormone or cytokine IL-6. So in terms of this talk, I'm going to go over a review of recent literature on the immune response to SARS-CoV-2 infection, detail assay development within the NHS Clinical Immunology Laboratory in terms of adaptive immune responses, describe my group's previous research into IL-6, and detail our current plans for further COVID-focused research. And so I'll start with this paper that was released last week, which describes a study carried out in Hong Kong where they took excess lung tissue from patients that were COVID negative and cultured them in a culture dish, followed by infection with either SARS-CoV-1 virus, which led to the SARS epidemic in 2003, or the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which leads to COVID-19. The samples were then assayed at 48 hours for infection and expression of immune response genes. So we can see in this data how both SARS-CoV-1 and CoV-2 leads to the development of productive viral infection, so that there's an actual increase in the viral titer in the culture supernatant following infection with both viruses. It's interesting to note that it's higher for most of the, for all of the donors in the SARS-CoV-2 infections. So one of the immune response genes that they assayed were the interferon genes, which are known to be antiviral. And they noticed the difference here in the difference between CoV-1 and CoV-2, in that COVID-1 did lead to expression of interferon beta, an antiviral gene, and that this wasn't seen in SARS-CoV-2 infection. And this might be due to differences in the viral genome leading to viral production of anti-interferon proteins.
James, I'm just going to interrupt for 1 second to just make a request to make sure that everyone has their video turned off, if that's right. Could everyone please make sure their video is turned off? Thank you very much.
Okay, so these cytokines are immune signaling proteins, and I'm just going to go over a few of them. So interferons are signaling proteins that are secreted by virtually all cells in response to viral infection. Interferon receptors are present on most cells, and binding of the cytokine triggers an intracellular transduction cascade that leads to the production of antiviral proteins, upregulation of immune surveillance molecules and cell cycle arrest. So that cell cycle arrest is important because you're stopping the cell from continuing to proliferate and propagate the virus. TNF is another immune signaling protein that promotes apoptotic cell death, cachexia, and inflammation. Receptor binding leads to an inflammatory signaling cascade and cell death cascades. IL-6 is a pro-inflammatory cytokine. Binding of IL-6 to its receptor again initiates signal transduction, leading to cell growth and differentiation. And I'll detail that more later on in the talk. So following the infection of these ex vivo lung tissue slices, samples were assayed for the production of immune genes. And it was interesting to note here that both SARS-CoV-1 and CoV-2 led to the production of IL-6. The other inflammatory genes were also produced from this tissue. This is in keeping with what we know from SARS infection, in that SARS infection of a epithelial cell line can lead to direct production of IL-6 from the actual epithelial tissue. So a summary of this paper is that infection of lung tissue by coronaviruses leads to productive viral replication, production of pro-inflammatory cytokines, including IL-6 and IL-1 beta, and production of inflammatory cell recruiting chemokines. So these are immune signaling molecules that draw immune cells into the infected tissue. So I've taken this paper, this review of adaptive immune responses from a paper written by Tony Fauci in 2006. And in it, it describes the response to influenza, but this is actually fairly consistent with all known respiratory viral infections. What occurs is you get an increase in viral titer as the viral replication occurs in the host tissue. This leads to the symptoms, fever, lower respiratory tract infection. Following this, you get an adaptive immune response. And the critical thing for an adaptive immune response is you need clonal expansion of the rare antigen-specific antipathogen clones of T and B cells that can recognize and fight the infection. And they have to clonally expand and proliferate, and that takes time. So you get a mounting adaptive immune response of CD8 T cells and a mounting response caused by B cell proliferation and differentiation secretion of serum or antibodies. When these responses occur, you get the pathogen drop in viral titer. These cells persist into the memory phase of the response, and they persist at a higher frequency in the exposed individual, so that secondary encounter with the pathogen leads to a more rapid and vigorous response, hopefully at the level where you can actually prevent symptom development or disease. So what do we know in terms of COVID-19? So this paper was released in March of this year and describes the clinical course and immune features of a single patient who recovered. So this is a relatively mild case of coronavirus infection. And we can see that shortly after their symptoms started at day naught, they presented to the emergency room at day 4. So they were probably inoculated somewhere here around day 7. Following admission, they were found to have high titers in their nasopharyngeal swab and other external secretions that led to detectable virus. Quite soon after admission, those detectable virus actually fell to below the level of detection by day 7, and the patient recovered. Tracking of their immune system shows that in both B and T cells, there was a clonal expansion that coincided with this drop in viral titer in their secretions. And in this plot, which is a FACS plot, you can see the emergence of a population highlighted here and here that expresses markers, so these are protein markers, that correlate with becoming an antibody secreting cell. So this is quite a large proportion in relation to normal immune responses of antigen, presumably antibody secreting cells that persist after the infection. So we also see this response mirrored in the CD8 T cell response, and CD8 T cells can kill virally infected cells And again, by day 8 and day 9, you get a large percentage of activated, so these are markers of activated CD8 T cells, CD38 and HLA-DR, and you can see a large percentage of circulating T cells developing these activation markers. And this coincides or peaks just after the virus becomes undetectable in the patient's secretions. So in terms of our clinical immunology laboratory, two of my colleagues, Dr. Sarah Lear and Rainer Doffinger, have set up an assay to try and be able to detect these neutralizing antibodies, or these antibodies that can actually fight the infection. And the standard methodology for doing this is by an ELISA technique, where you incubate your target protein, wash over the patient's serum so that any anti-SARS protein binds to it, and then detect that with a second antibody following a wash with a chemical on it that can actually lead to an amplification signal so that you can detect the presence of binding. Now, the problem with this assay is it requires large amounts of protein, which is quite limited in current circumstances, and can only assay one protein at a time. Within the clinical immunology department, we have a bead-based technology and a multiplex Luminex machine, which can actually detect multiple different types of antibody binding to different SARS coronaviruses proteins. So in this work, they've been incredibly grateful and helped by researchers within CITID and within the LMB, who have been making different components of the COVID-19 protein, and those are listed here. So the great thing about the Luminex technology for the detection of these serum antibodies is you need tiny, minuscule amounts of the test protein. So we estimate that even with our current lots, we can expand within the department to up to 50,000 tests. So the assay has been set up, and this has been initial validation tests have actually been carried out with 37 COVID-positive patient sera that was available within the diagnostic laboratory and 35 stored sera. And inter-assay and intra-assay variability studies are ongoing. However, our initial results are actually very promising. And this is a ROC curve analysis, the receiver operating curve analysis, which decides what the optimum cutoff should be for a test to achieve optimal sensitivity or specificity looking for the analyte. So if you are looking for kind of positive anti-COVID serology, if you choose a cutoff around here, you will have a test that is very sensitive but not very specific, whereas a cutoff around here will be specific but not very sensitive. If you take the midpoint around here, you get one that achieves both. And so we do have an assay that appears to be both very sensitive and very specific. So the validation will continue, and I put on their email addresses for anybody who wants to contact them directly in relation to this. So I'm going to pause here. In terms of all the data that I've just shown you is in relation to patients that recover from COVID and the normal immune response in terms of patients that are going to do well. What do we know about patients that die from this condition? Now, the data from that is much scarcer, much harder to find. So I actually thought I'd actually highlight this paper, which was released last week, which describes the use of the antiviral drug remdesivir in the compassionate use of this drug for patients with severe COVID-19, because it highlights the clinical course of patients that are doing badly from this condition. So in this swimmer chart, what they've done is they've actually colored the patients by their initial requirements for ventilatory support. So the dark brown are patients that were on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, so that's the most extensive form of ventilatory support you can get. The dark red are mechanically ventilated, and then that goes down to patients on oxygen supplementation. However, all of the patients entered into this trial were caused, there was concern in the doctors looking after them, so they are a particularly problematic group. One of the things that you can see is the clinical course is extensive, and the patients persist with this inflammatory disease that goes on for a very long time. In the course of this trial, 53 patients were treated and 7 unfortunately died. And actually, if we take what they actually died from, I think this highlights some of the problems in terms of the pathogenesis of this condition, in that one patient died from septic shock. And this is, you know, one of the reasons for this is that patients that suffer, have a bad outcome from coronavirus infection, are those that have comorbidities. And so there is a distinct subgroup of these patients that die from their comorbidity or from secondary problems such as bacterial infection. There's two patients that died from respiratory distress. So that's caused by the actual problems within the lungs and the respiratory failure that led to their ventilation. But four of the patients have died from a multi-organ system failure. And this is frequently seen in patients even within our own hospital. So what's different in these patients? Well, two studies have recently come out looking at features of patients that are dying versus patients that are surviving in the epidemic in China. And one of the hallmarks of patients that do badly is this raised level of the cytokine IL-6. And this was seen in this study and in a second independent study where high levels of IL-6 seem to differentiate those that die versus those that live. So the excess levels of IL-6 have drawn a lot of attention, and this data was taken from a paper from Carl June, because the anti-IL-6R drug tocilizumab has just been approved by the FDA for the treatment of the cytokine release syndrome caused by multi-organ toxicity of CAR T cells. So CAR T cells are engineered T lymphocytes that are against a cancer, and normally it's been successful in cancers of hematological malignancies where the cancer cells are disseminated throughout the body, and we infuse the patients with CAR T cells. And one of the complications is you do get an excess level of IL-6 and consequently a multi-system problem causing hemodynamic instability, liver failure, and respiratory failure. And the anti-IL-6R drug has been so successful in this that it's actually now in main treatment protocols for treatment with CAR T cells. So last year, we described the first patient reported with an interleukin-6 receptor deficiency, and this enabled us to provide some insights into the biology of IL-6 signaling. So the patient was born with a frameshift mutation, a homozygous frameshift mutation, in exon 4 of their IL-6R gene, so they had no protein expression. And in the paper, we went on to do multiple studies, gene correction studies, that showed that the IL-6R was deficient, that this led to an absent signaling, and could be corrected. The patient suffered from recurrent infections with both staphylococci infections, such as highlighted here with this boil, and with atopic skin disease. Now, IL-6 is part of a group of cytokines that all signal the shared machinery. What happens is the IL-6 cytokine binds the receptor, IL-6 receptor, and then the combined complex is presented to the GP130 signal transduction molecule. This leads to a wave of phosphorylation in JAK proteins, leading to phosphorylation of STAT3 that nuclear translocates and leads to expression of genes that lead to cell growth and differentiation signals. And this GP130 JAK STAT3 pathway is shared in terms of cytokines that signal, such as IL-11 and IL-27, but there are others. So we reported this patient who has an absolute absence of their IL-6R. And one of the first things to note was the kind of clinical features of this patient, and then she kept on getting soft tissue infections and chest infections, so she was also susceptible to Haemophilus. And with these infections, she did mount a kind of exaggerated neutrophil response with each infective episode and an eosinophilic response. However, the striking thing was that her CRP was never detectable. So Pepys in the 70s had described that CRP is under the control of IL-6, it's made in the liver, and raised levels of IL-6 can raise the levels of your CRP. Our report of this patient's clarified that absolutely no other cytokine leads to CRP production, because the protein wasn't, the CRP wasn't just low, it was absolutely never detected. So this is also important in terms of patients treated with tocilizumab, because if a patient with tocilizumab has a detectable CRP, it means that their IL-6 blockade is incomplete and perhaps a dose increase may be warranted. In terms of other things we noted in the patient, one of the things that frequently happens when you get a ligand binding a cell surface cytokine receptor is you get ligand-mediated receptor downregulation. So it's obvious that the patient has a high level of GP130 relative to the healthy controls, and the patient is different. They have an absence of their IL-6R. But this also tells us so much more about normal IL-6 signaling, and it shows that IL-6 is present in healthy individuals and exposed to their blood cells all the time, and it's leading to a persistent level of GP130 downregulation in their T cells. So this leads to the question of why aren't we all getting cytokine release syndrome all the time? And this is because the signaling from IL-6 is exquisitely regulated by the immune system. So the only cells in the unchallenged person that express the IL-6R are white blood cells and the liver. And so you can get binding of the cytokine to the receptor, presentation to GP130 in the signal transduction cascade. Now, in other tissues, for those cells to respond to IL-6, what has to happen is the presence of infiltrating immune cells. And these infiltrating immune cells can shed the IL-6R, and that can lead to binding of the cytokine and transpresentation leading to the signaling cascade. So in terms of CAR T cell therapy, where you have a disseminated blood cell cancer and you infuse a load of activated immune cells to fight that cancer, you have both the release of IL-6 and the presence of infiltrating immune cells shedding the IL-6R. So it leads to the point of whether measurement of the IL-6R will be useful in coronavirus infection. Now, I'm just going to draw you into another paper that was recently published in Nature, which highlighted this fact that actually this feature of the reduction in viral shedding seems to be apparent in a lot of patients, whether they're sick or well. And we can't detect the throat swab being positive in patients that have been in hospital quite often for a period of time. So is this viral shedding data sufficient to rule out IL-6 production being caused by ongoing viral replication within the patient? So what I'm asking here is, are we just assuming that there is an inflammatory phase, or is this actually driven by ongoing viral replication? So to finish off, I just want to highlight that one of the most frequently things I've heard discussed in terms of this remdesivir paper is that we mustn't overinterpret it. It's not a randomized controlled trial. But I want to remind everybody of what happened the last time the world awaited a randomized controlled trial for a drug that treated an untreatable epidemic. And we got this paper in 1987. Azt, cytobutadiene, is similar to remdesivir in that they're both nucleoside analogs. And in this paper, they reported that actually 19 of the placebo patients and only one of the AZD recipient patients died during the study. And they also seem to have problems with the AZT-treated patients had less evidence of opportunistic infections. Now, throughout my time at medical school, this paper was cited as a problem because effectively none of the findings reported in this 87 paper were actually translatable into the clinic. So what was the consequence of this? Was the actual drug wrong, or was this a failure? And there's multiple discussions about what went wrong in this trial. And one of the concerns were patients in both placebo and control arms sharing their drugs? Was there problems with selection of which patients received placebo or versus the treated arms? And was it possible for the blinding to be carried out efficiently when there was a clear effect of the drug when patients were treated with this? So throughout my time at medical school, HIV was still, treatment for HIV was still being sought. But did this poor translatability of this trial's results into the clinic mean that AZT was bad? Well, effectively, no, because AZT formed the backbone from the successful triple therapy combination regimes that came out in 1997. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that IL-6R is a valid target. However, the current rationale for monotherapy is entirely dependent on host immunity being sufficient to control the virus. Now, is it, in terms of those groups of patients, the elderly, those with comorbidities, that may have other reasons for their immune system to not work as well? Hopefully combination therapy trials, if required, will be more rapidly achievable than for HIV. So I'm just going to briefly touch on my own research group's work at the moment. One of the things that I just want to highlight is that although much work has gone on about the interaction between the SARS spike protein and the ACE2 receptor, the SARS virus was also shown to actually infect dendritic cells via an interaction with DC-cyne. So DC-cyne is present on dendritic cells, and these are the cells that actually orchestrate adaptive immune responses. And there's an incredible similarity between SARS-CoV virus and the SARS-CoV-2 virus's spike proteins. And that's what we've seen in terms of their same utilization of the entry receptor. So our group has hypothesizing that infection with dendritic cells via DC-cyne could lead to widespread viral dissemination and a failure of immune control. So Tiffany Mann has already established a cell culture system where we can actually differentiate monocytes into dendritic cells, because these are incredibly rare within the immune system, and differentiate them into cells expressing DC-cyne. So with this, we can assess if in primary human tissue, DC-cyne expressing cells can be infected. We can then investigate the viral life cycle and then hopefully set up co-culture systems and see if this is a system by how viral infection can be disseminated throughout the body without hinging on the secretions from the respiratory system. So thank you very much.
Excellent. Thanks very much, James. So if people have got any questions, they're welcome to now put them into the chat. So I see we have got a few messages. I'm just actually going to start by asking James a question myself. So, James, I think you said the other day that your patient with IL-6 receptor deficiency was susceptible to bacterial infections, but hasn't so far shown increased susceptibility to viral infections. Is that correct?
Yes. So the patient is actually, their main complaint is actually the horrific atopic skin disease they've got. So there's a bias in their differentiation to an atopic phenotype of their immune cells, and that's infiltrating their skin. They do get intermittent infections, and when they get them, they can be very severe, but they are restricted to infections with staphylococcal infections or Haemophilus.
So I suppose if someone would say, well, it's all very well giving patients with SARS-CoV-2 tocilizumab to try and damp down the cytokine storm, but we may be potentiating viral replication, and that was a point you made. I think it would probably also be fair to say there's no a priori reason to suspect that antagonizing IL-6 should potentiate viral replication. Is that a fair comment?
It is. I think it's important to remember that tocilizumab was first licensed for the treatment of multicentric Castleman's disease, which is a viral infection caused by KSHV. And its action there is to stop the proliferation of virally infected cells disseminating the virus within their own genomes.
Okay, so that is a slight concern. And then, in answer to, if one was to say, is what's the evidence that the IL-6 in SARS-CoV-2 infection in particular is causative of the pathology rather than a bystander of it? I think it's fair to say we don't have strong evidence of that at the moment. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think we have any evidence as to what the role of IL-6 is in this infection. The important thing is that actually it could be, you know, infection of primary tissue, not necessarily immune tissue, can lead to production of IL-6. So if the IL-6 is still being produced, does that indicate that that tissue is still being infected?
Okay, so let's just go to a couple of questions in the chat. So one question is, a couple of people have asked, what's actually driving the IL-6 production in these settings? Do we know the answer to that, James?
I think people are speculating that it's related to the IL-1 beta, then leading to NF-kappa-BS signal transduction and production of the IL-6.
Okay, so it all comes down to that, fine. And then someone says, do DC cells, do dendritic cells express ACE2? That I suspect you don't know the answer to, maybe you do.
There's no evidence in terms of the databases that do transcription. Obviously, we will stain for that, and it will be sensible in terms of our studies, CRISPR knockouting both DC sign and ACE2 to actually formally prove the receptor.
Okay, and so then we've got one more question here from Babak. Do we have any transplant or immune compromised patients with COVID-19 recently? So the answer is actually I'm not sure, Babak. So we have had one patient, I think, with a incompletely controlled HIV who has had COVID-19 infection. And I don't think their course has been particularly severe. And I think that reflects other people's anecdotal experience at other centres. I'm not aware of any severely immunocompromised patients amongst our cohort, but they may well they may well exist. Someone thinks the same. All right, excellent. So so Aaron says he has plenty. Good. All right. Well, thanks very much, everyone. So that's going to draw this to a conclusion. Next week, we're going to have a guest speaker who's an expert coronavirus virologist, Chris Coleman. So I definitely encourage everyone to call in again then. Thank you very much for listening.